Hi, I'm Liz Stillwagon at the Center for Inquiry in Amherst, New York, and I am sitting here today with Ron Geary, Professor Emeritus of the Center for Philosophy of Science at University of Minnesota.
Hi.
Hi. Thank you for joining us. We're going to be discussing philosophical naturalism, and the first question I have is, what is your brief definition of philosophical naturalism?
You expect a brief answer from a philosopher? No. The first part is the really simple part. Naturalism is the opposite of supernaturalism. That's the easy part. But beyond that, it's the idea that you don't appeal to like a priori principles. You don't appeal to any philosophical principle that's sort of transcendental. Now, the more down-to-earth way to say, you start out by saying, we just take what natural sciences can tell us, and actually folk knowledge too is natural. Okay, and so that's the beginning point. Now we can get a little more specific.
Okay, that's a good start.
But somebody said, what you want is really California natural. Okay, no additives.
No additives. Okay, pure organic.
Yeah.
And to what extent can you agree with philosophical naturalism?
That's easy. I'm an advocate.
Okay.
But of course, everybody has their little flavor of it. I'll get a little more thing. It's actually very hard to state positively. I said negatively, it's really easy. Like you don't allow into your theorizing supernatural things, right, or non-natural things. The real problem is how do you know what's natural?
That's a good question.
Yeah, so that's where things get a little complicated. Like what counts as natural? Some people say, well, it's what the natural sciences tell you, but that doesn't work because is it what the natural sciences tell you now? Well, they keep going, right? So it'd have to be, well, the natural sciences today tell us. You could say that, but that doesn't give you a general formulation. You can't say what natural sciences will ever tell us because who knows what that is, right? So you have to be a little careful about saying, well, this is what we do as a claim.
Okay.
So I'm inclined to go to take what might be called a methodological turn and say more than saying, well, naturalism is just the view that the world only contains natural processes, which is for us almost sounds like a tautology. I mean, what else, right? I think it's a little more interesting to focus on what you might call the methodology, which is to say, well, you got a problem. I mean, pick a big problem. What's the cause of cancer? I mean, right? Okay. Now, so you've got a problem. The question is, what are we going to do about this problem? Well, the answer is, well, we'll investigate it using the best current methods we have for doing this kind of thing, right? So it's medical research, it's genetics, whatever. Okay. That's your... You do that, and you see what happens. You see what comes out, and if you get, if you get a nice result, then you say, okay, provisionally we've done that one with, I'll say just sort of standard scientific methods. I'm not going to be fancy about that, and that's the methodology, okay, and that's sort of the way to do it. Now, what's the how do you justify that methodology? Well. Success. Like, the big success in the last century was life. People used to say, you can't explain life. You can explain the stars, the moon, but you can't explain life. That requires something special. Mm-hmm. Okay. I think at the end of the 20th century, the naturalistic discovery, genetics, before that, evolutionary theory, said, okay, we pretty much naturalistic understand where life came from, how it works, what makes it go, and so that's a successful naturalistic inquiry. Okay, so my view sometimes is, okay, we've done life, now next stop, consciousness.
Right.
Go ahead.
The next one. Okay. And just to clarify, you made this distinction in your talk between methodological naturalism and ontological naturalism, and you want to say that we should focus on the methodology, but once we have good conclusions, those methodologies work, then you're willing to grant some sort of theoretical naturalism.
Yes, yeah. I mean, then what I don't want is to come out with kind of a metaphysical statement that, you know, right? Because at that level, the question is, how would you justify it?
Right.
Right. And the last thing a naturalist is going to do is say, well, I have an a priori argument
right.
that this is right, right? That would be self-defeating.
Okay.
Right.
So methodology first.
Yeah, but then of course you get the conclusions.
Right.
But I think you get specific conclusions. But there are big ones, like, you know, I think we understand pretty much how life works, how organic life works. That's
okay.
A big thing. I say, great, check one for naturalism.
Right, and on to the next problem. Okay, so if you do agree with naturalism, generally speaking, is there a specific version of philosophical naturalism that you would recommend to other philosophers?
Yeah, I keep recommending the go methodological.
Okay, go methodological.
That's a general recommendation. Focus on the methodology.
Okay.
I mean, you get the conclusions from the methodology. I mean, when you know if things come out nice, which they mostly don't, but eventually if they do, then you say, okay, you've got the conclusions. But I'd say when you think about naturalism, think about the approach, the methodology.
Okay.
This is very much in the tradition of pragmatism.
Right. Okay, that's great. Then along those same lines, what are some important real-world practical implications of philosophical naturalism? So maybe some specific examples of applying the methodology.
The one I'm currently interested in is actually the connection to secularism and secular society, and actually sort of my ideas of liberal democracy.
Okay.
Okay, if you want something big, yeah, that's
okay.
But no,
do
I'm
you want to give us a brief definition
well,
of liberal
I think
democracy?
That, yeah, well, no, I can't do that.
Okay.
But I think it's important in a liberal democracy, and actually in an ideal one, is that so to speak, everybody's on the same footing, and anything is up for discussion, which means that nobody should be able to say, well, this is right because it's in my Bible, or this is right because of some revelation, right? Because then there's nothing to discuss.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's say, well, you know this is right, and I say, well, yeah, but how do I know it's right? And they say, well, you haven't had the experience. Well, you see, that's not something that you can just discuss. I think in a liberal democracy, everybody ought to be able to discuss everything and have all kinds of arguments, okay? But you shouldn't be able to say, well, okay, stop. here's I have the truth from on high.
Right.
See, that's what I think the naturalist approach says. No, we won't do that. So even you might say even methodologically in our discussions, we won't do that. We'll point you to all kinds of things that are happening in the world. Do you like this? Is that, you know, and everything, and it's give and take.
Mm-hmm.
And so you don't get direct answers out of this. But what you do is, so to speak, the methodology. It's the way you conduct the discussions, right?
Right.
And that goes to policy, even policies. We heard another talk at but like things like stem cell research, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, there are lots of considerations about what kind of research this is and various things, and there are arguments all around. But the one argument that you see, I think, should be off the table is that our theology tells us that, you know, four cells is a living being or something like that, right?
Because, again, it's an a priori argument.
Well, it's an a priori, or it's,
mm-hmm.
That's non-natural. I mean, it's come from an authoritative source,
mm-hmm.
that not everybody can enter into, not everybody can discuss.
Okay.
So that's the problem.
Right.
It's where some people claim an authority that nobody else can have, whereas my idea of secularism is, everybody has equal authority, let's put it that way, right?
Okay.
In the sense that everybody has able to print their opinion and give their arguments, and nobody can sort of say, you know, well, sorry, but I've got the truth.
But that's including the arguments that come from theological sources.
But people may give those arguments.
Uh-huh.
But I say that's what you want the secular society is that. Yeah. in a way you want to say, well, you can't use those. You can use your ethical beliefs,
mm-hmm.
but you can't argue them on the basis of your superior authority.
Okay.
That's the methodological question. So a secular society, you wouldn't do that. I think that's something called the principle of non-dogmatism.
Right. Okay. So everyone is on an equal footing, equal ground. There's no sort of higher.
Yeah. You can't sort of opt out. You can't appeal out of the system, as it were.
Okay.
But that leaves open a whole wide variety, you know, range of things. But I think that's important to. So naturalism goes to secularism, goes to liberal democracy. So if you want to say, what's the really important thing? For me, that's my interest there. But I've been interested in naturalism before I had that motivation.
Okay. And like we're witnessing at this conference, many philosophers do call themselves philosophical naturalists. And perhaps it is a dominant philosophy today. What do you think is the cause for this?
I'm glad that it's dominant, because when I started doing it, it wasn't. I'm glad to hear people say, oh, this is dominant. That's fun. Okay,
yeah.
So great. We've been doing something
Maybe
right.
Maybe wishful thinking.
Yeah, right. Maybe it's not just wishful thinking. I can't speak sort of outside of philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
But in philosophy, I think partly it was just growing disillusionment with the old way of doing philosophy. And part of it, I think, was analytic philosophy got a bit stale.
Hmm.
People didn't like the method. Oh, the method of counterexamples and intuition. You say, you want to ask, you know, what's justice? And they say, well, you give a definition, and somebody says, well, yeah, but this fits your definition, but it's obviously not just by our intuitions. Hmm. And you play this sort of analysis and counterexample game. And the idea is to come up with the right definition, the correct analysis. Okay. And I think a lot of people decided, well, maybe this isn't so interesting, or maybe there isn't an analysis of things. Mm-hmm. And this is a point made by Wittgenstein, you know, what is it now, 60 years ago, that things don't have essences. Somebody put it that way, right? So the essence you could capture in a definition. You know, it's just if and only if, and now you give umpteen conditions that define it, okay, which would be an analysis, right?
Right.
So I think naturalism partly was just an alternative.
Mm-hmm.
That's, I think, one thing that's sort of important. There may be it's almost a naturalistic explanation, as most movements can't go more than about 3 or 4 generations before people get tired of them. I mean, except centuries-old religious traditions, but that's a very special kind of case.
Yeah.
But intellectual movements, you get people who are really good, and you get the second generation, third generation, and then people starting wanting something new.
Yeah. And I wonder, too, if in my own area, in the mind sciences or cognitive science, if just the rise of information that we're acquiring from technology and science is sort of pushing people who work in philosophy of mind more in that direction.
Yeah, I actually, I don't work in that field, but
mm-hmm.
I do understand that the science has gotten so exciting, and actually getting some results. Maybe not as many as people hype, but
right.
but the science has gotten really exciting.
Yeah,
it's the same thing happened in. I said we've explained life. The same thing happened in biology.
Mm-hmm.
With the rise of molecular biology. That is, the biology got to be so good, so exciting, and really getting where that it forced people to consider it more. So that, I mean, heretically, I think traditional philosophy of mind, philosophy of language is gone.
Mm.
I remember when I was an undergraduate, philosophy departments taught courses in memory and perception. These were standard topics in philosophy.
Right.
Well, I mean, those are long gone.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, no philosophy. The psychology and the cognitive sciences have taken over those topics for sure.
Right.
And so my induction is that philosophy of mind is going to go the same way, and even philosophy of language.
Wow.
Because language is a cognitive phenomenon.
So it's not so much that it's disappearing, but it's sort of being absorbed.
I think being absorbed, but
the
whole method of doing it,
mm-hmm.
that mode of talking about the mind, I think it will disappear.
Okay.
I once had an argument with my colleagues. They said we should hire a new person in philosophy of mind, and I said, well, look, mm-hmm. if you hire a new person with a fresh PhD, by the time they retire, the field won't exist.
Right.
This was not too popular.
Wow. Okay. Does some particular criticism of philosophical naturalism seem to urgently need an answer by naturalists, in your view?
I don't see any sort of one particular big thing.
Mm-hmm.
I'll mention one, which it actually came up today, but one of the non-naturalist arguments is the existence of norms, normativity.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that may be the thing that people come back to the most, and like moral norms, right? Like where do they come from?
If not from
something non-natural source,
okay,
as it were, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you don't have to be an indigenous authority to have that view. When people say they don't like it, you know, they're unhappy with naturalism, that seems to me one of the biggest things that comes up. And I have to think harder now. Why is this a problem?
Mm-hmm.
But they have a little bit too narrow a view of naturalism or even science. It's sort of somewhat purely descriptive, right? And therefore, you can't get prescriptions from pure descriptions,
mm-hmm.
right? And I say, well, you can get some prescriptions, like how to do things, okay, from what you know in science. But then there's another completely different source for, important ones like moral norms. I actually still believe in a fact-value distinction. The science tells us how the world is, but put it this way, that underdetermines how we should live. There are lots of ways that you could organize a society that are completely compatible with everything we know scientifically.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so there's a leftover, right? And it's an important leftover, right? And but I think, where does that come from? Well, it comes from natural sources, which is history. There's some in our biological basis, but the science underdetermines the morality,
mm-hmm.
and the basis of morality is mainly just historical. I mean, humans did these various things. They could have done other things,
right?
In different parts of the world, they do other things, right? And but the naturalist view is there's nothing beyond that. That is, you can't say, well, our way is right because, and then you sort of reach up here and say, okay.
Mm-hmm.
But norms naturally arrive in any kind of community. You don't have to have more than 25 people in a primitive tribe, and presume you got then you get division of labor.
Mm-hmm.
The first one, of course, is men and women. That's the obvious division of labor for humans, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there are certain things that women do and certain things that men do, and now you've got norms. Like, you know, you're a man, you're not supposed to do that. You're a woman, you're not supposed to do that. So I mean, the norms just come up just from the idea you need social organization.
Right. That's interesting.
But how they develop is another question.
I wonder if that leads to the view, and not necessarily, but I'm thinking, I wonder if it leads to a morally relativistic
theory. I'm afraid so.
Theory,
but
does
it's
it?
Not, but it's not a silly relativist. It's not like anything goes.
Right.
Right. You know, when people say that, you know, anything goes, I say, just try driving down Main Street at 75 miles an hour, and you'll see whether anything goes.
Right.
Answer, no. Right? The society is there to do that. So sometimes I say, you know, we don't need a god to make us moral. Society can do it.
Okay.
And societies just naturally evolve.
Mm-hmm.
It's a relativity, but it's pretty deep.
Okay.
And it's culture deep.
Mm-hmm.
So the big questions of moral relativity aren't the little things, you know, like you and me and stuff. No. That's not the worry. The big worry is in different cultures, which now in the world is Islam versus everybody else.
Yeah.
And actually, my view is that the worst thing in the world for the West to do is to revive the Crusades, which is to say, revive Christianity as the opposition to the Muslim world. I said, oh, no, come, we've done that. That was 1,000 years ago, right? And, of course, they still think that way. They call us Crusaders.
Right? Yeah.
I said, no, we want to be secularists, and we want to understand what they're doing. We understand what they want and what their views, and then we should try and deal with them. I mean, they're not going to go away, but to oppose the one culture with the other in that way seems to be not smart.
Right.
So the secular view, I think, is the smart way to deal with what is indeed a very serious clash of cultures, and of course that's very deep.
Yeah.
So that's okay. Another good thing about secularism is it tells you how we should deal with rising Islam, which is, it's going to be with it. It's for probably the rest of my life, maybe even the rest of your life.
And then specifically, how does it tell us to deal with it? To sort of be open-minded, try to foster an open dialogue, or?
Yes. Everything. Mm-hmm. But the secularism part is to try and understand it.
Okay.
And to engage them at a level of understanding. Now, there are some things, you're just not going to possibly agree.
Mm-hmm.
But if we regard it as a threat, the idea is to say, okay, but let's understand the threat. And let's understand what are the best ways of dealing with it as a natural phenomenon.
Okay? Yeah.
And not just retreat to our own ideology, which then it's just going to be conflict.
Right.
Or put it such a, maybe you want conflict management, but it's on a big scale.
Yeah.
And to be very careful.
Yeah, I like that approach of thinking of prescriptions sort of emerging out of descriptions, because it is culture specific, but it also lends itself to this sort of open dialogue and mutual criticism, not in a negative sense, but in a open for a critique, open for understanding.
Mm-hmm. Right. I think that's very good. Yeah, right. You have to have somebody to talk to.
Right.
But also, I mean, even if you're dealing with fanaticism,
mm-hmm.
the idea is to understand fanaticism. What causes fanaticism?
Right.
What makes it work? And then start trying, if you can, sort of start dealing with the causes of that.
Yeah.
Okay. That's, you want to get down to that rather than just say, well, we are in a war on terror. Well, that just gives you a war.
Yeah.
What you really want to do is understand the roots of fanaticism, and then figure out how to deal with that as mm-hmm. a natural problem.
Right. Okay.
That's my big view on that.
Okay. And maybe this sort of gets to my next question, which is, how would you describe the future of naturalism? So maybe dealing with this current world issue that we have is one way of.
There are two questions. What do I hope for, and what do I think will happen?
Sure.
Obviously, what I hope for. It's very hard to know what actually will happen.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I don't think there's any grand plan for life on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
It might be very contingent on what countries, what people do. Maybe not so much what individuals do, but what nations do,
mm-hmm.
What leaders do. And sometimes I'm optimistic, sometimes I'm pessimistic. But I'm sort of on the side of, I haven't given up working on it.
Right, right.
And I haven't given up talking about it and trying to promote a naturalistic and a secular view of things.
Mm.
But will it in the end be successful? I'm not sure. Yeah. People used to be very optimistic about since the scientific revolution, right? By the march of science, da 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 da, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I used to believe in that. And when I was growing up, it seemed, oh, wonderful, right? And mm-hmm. when I decided religion didn't matter to my life, having been brought up in a fairly strict Protestant background, I decided it didn't matter. I thought, well, everybody thinks that way. Religion will just disappear. Well,
Definitely
have. I could not have been more wrong.
Yeah. And if you think of the idea of two systems co-evolving, you know, one sort of progresses and then the other one progresses in turn, and so I wonder if something like that, a model like that, could be used to explain what's going on here, because the science is making so much progress, but we don't see in turn religion sort of falling by the wayside. And
no, we don't. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And of course, one of my interests now is why.
Right.
I mean, I think it's a really interesting question.
Mm-hmm.
That is, you know, those of us who not, and this is not just me, I mean, for a century people thought, oh, well, you know, religion will wither and go away, right? Well, this has not happened.
Right.
And now the real question is why?
Right.
What's going on here?
Yeah.
And that again, that's a very important thing to investigate. What is going on? We must not have understood something.
There right.
must be something we were missing.
Yeah. And you think that this is a project for philosophers of science to take on, to look at the, did you say that, call it the science of religion?
Yeah,
or
there is a project. This is more narrowly professional, but there is a project which is, the scientific study of religion.
Okay.
Which is, okay, here's this phenomenon. It's a very important phenomenon. People think it's not important. They've missed the boat, right? No, it's a very important phenomenon. It's a very influential phenomenon. And so, if you're a naturalist, you say, hey, we have a problem here. What do? Well, let's take the best scientific method he's got, and let's see if we can't understand this problem.
Okay.
About the existence and the persistence of religion. So, yeah. So, a philosopher, now, for philosophers of science is, well, there is a science now.
Mm-hmm.
It's rather dispersed among various disciplines. But there is a scientific inquiry as to how is religion origin, what makes it start, and then what makes it persist. The persistence is a more interesting question now, since it's
okay.
Obviously started. Okay. But still. And I think, professionally as a philosopher of science, say, come on, here's an area of science now, right? Philosophers of science are dealing with science. So, why don't we look at this area of science and do what philosophers of science do, which is the meta level, try to understand the science and sort of try and figure out what's going on to tell other people.
And what makes it a science? Just the applying the scientific method or scientific method of inquiry to
right. Well,
the
people are doing it. Yeah, people are
religion?
Doing it. You know, people in evolutionary theory, evolutionary psychology,
okay, like
genetics,
you were talking about in your talk.
Cognitive science.
Okay.
Some people have been doing your neuroscience.
Right.
Just to understand, you know, what makes religion so powerful and why adherents are so devoted to it.
Okay.
Yeah, but you have all these sciences are there working
right.
on this problem. And so a philosopher of science can say, oh, great, we study what scientists do. Let's look at these scientists and then understand what they're doing
right.
about the problem.
So philosophers of science can play not necessarily the role of debunking religion, but just trying to understand it from a naturalistic perspective.
Although I still have the old view. It's not sort of debunking, but it's like Darwin made the argument from design irrelevant. Like, you can explain design naturalistically, the appearance of design, right? And so if you understand religion scientifically, you say you don't have to postulate that there really is a supernatural, which explains why there's religion, of course. Right? But you say, no, we can understand naturally why there should be religion, why there should be the belief in the supernatural,
right.
even though there isn't a supernatural.
Okay.
So I still have it. I wouldn't call it debunking, but it is a deflationary.
Deflationary, right.
It is deflationary.
Okay.
So it's the same strategy Darwin used for organic life.
Thank you so much for talking to us today.
My pleasure.